everybody. Gus here again. Welcome to episode 5. This week, we'll be covering chapter 16, The Course of True Love, 17, How Dogs Are Trained, and 18, Tea and Vengeance. Last week, I had promised everyone that I would put a link in the show notes for our email address if you have any comments or questions or notes for us. So I'll just say it right now and I'll put it in the show notes this week. Our email is at laudcast@gmail.com. That is LAWDCAST@gmail.com. All right, guys, I'll tell you what we're reading next week at the end of the episode. See you then.
That's a crazy thing to say, Ian.
He's got some Kwai energy.
Big Kwai energy.
Big Kwai energy, yeah.
Well, that was a joke for our last ep, I think, was Big Kwai energy.
Big Kwai energy, oh god. BQE.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first Laudcast. My name is Gus Storms, and these are my co-hosts, Ian Bertram.
Hey.
And Peter Schmidt.
What's up, everybody? We're recording on a Wednesday again. I mean, we're just all over the place. Monday, then Wednesday. Who knows where we're going?
It's been those two. I'm starting to get a predictive notion of what you're going to do in this bit. So, yes, it's Wednesday.
Wait to see what happens when we record on a Tuesday. That'll be chaos.
Yeah, anarchy. In this podcast, we will be examining the ins and outs of Joe Abercrombie's First Law trilogy, including peripheral novels and short stories, moving chapter by chapter through the works of our grim dark master. Guys, welcome.
Yes.
Again.
Thank you for having us.
I'll also note, before we really get into it, we'll be giving proper recognition to the audiobook versions of these works, primarily read by the great Stephen Pacey. They're fantastic reads off the page, but made better by Pacey's performance. So if you're reading along or listening along, I recommend buying whatever the version you're not engaging in.
Totally.
And particularly, I don't know if Pacey gets any dividend. I don't know what the royalties for doing an audiobook. I really hope that they're significant because, man, what a genius.
Oh, yeah. Incredible.
I hope so, too. I guess I've never really thought about that. I assume it's just some like work for hire shit.
It's probably a one off,
like, and it's like $5,000 and that's it, something like that.
He really brings the books to life in a different way, and it's very, very cool. So the premise of our cast is it's like a watch along podcast, but a read along. So we're working through currently.
I love the description watch along versus read along. Like that is like people won't understand what read along means.
Okay, shut up. I just don't, there aren't that many. We've talked about this. There aren't that many read-along podcasts, or I've never known of another one. So I like to make that little connection point, but we will be going through Joe Abercrombie's First Law trilogy, focusing currently on his book, The Blade Itself. Right now, I think, yeah, in this episode, we're doing chapters 16 through 18.
Yes. And mm-hmm. A key thing is that Peter has never read these books before. Gus and I have read them many times. So Peter is, fresh.
Yeah, I'm fresh as awesome. A baby's bottom on this one, guys. I'm like barely, I'm mostly hairless.
He's a sweet, sweet boy.
He's our delightful novice, and we're these wizened old masters of these texts. So
yeah,
guys,
authorities, right? That's what we said in the first one. You two are authorities.
Definitive authorities. We are academics of this work. So if you have a differing opinion on even any text that we quote or anything, you're wrong.
Yeah, fuck off. Get the fuck out of here. I'm behind these two. I'm protected by them. Fuck you.
No, and of
hold
course
back,
that's not
Peter.
True.
Peter, hold me back. Hold me back.
I'm holding you back right now. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are enthusiasts and not experts, but we're just enjoying this experience together.
Right. Totally. But go fuck yourself, though. Regardless.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. Especially you, Brett.
Oh, Brett. Yeah. Fuck Brett. God. don't get me started about Brett.
Or so, more specific, how's everyone? Or Trad. guys, so we debated on doing a record this week, and I don't want to give maybe too much context, date us too much for anyone listening later, but it's a crazy week.
Gus Evergreen Storms over here doesn't want to talk about COVID-19 and all the protests and all that because he's afraid we're going to get too political.
Also, we started this podcast really, I mean, partially because of the quarantine, which is a thing for all you people like 20 years down the road when this is a important archival document.
I think we were all sort of like just like black holes sucking all light into it, justifying our existence through like lies and drinking. Can't speak for you, Peter. And we needed something a little light, a little jubilant.
Some frivolity, for sure. Yes.
But it seems a little out of place during these times. But
yeah, I mean, the difference is that it used to be like we all need a little frivolity because of the existential crisis going on around us. Now it's more like, can we be doing something more useful with our time? Like it the world is dire.
As the rough beast slouches towards Bethlehem, we will record podcasts about the first law.
Oh my God.
So I think we're all taking all of this very seriously, but right now this is our little our sojourn into fun meaninglessness.
It's also not why you guys came to listen. So we will.
Okay, I wanted to give just a titch of context. Yeah, so we've had protests all throughout the world, in particular America,
all 50 states,
and people participating, and it's very cool. And
yeah. And Black Lives Matter, and we should just say that also, so that we're clear about where we stand on this.
Oh, yeah. Fuck Trump, Black Lives Matter, fuck institutional racism. It's all bad.
Yeah. Defund the police.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm a prison abolitionist, but we're talking about a fantasy book from 16 years ago, so that's useful.
I mean, I kind of appreciate, though, if we jump right into the book, that the first chapter, The Course of True Love,
a little fun.
We're going to go right into Giselle, and we're going to get right into, like, the most trite...
White male privilege, baby.
Like, white male privilege bullshit immediately coming off of this. That was something. I've never seen more spite than I've seen in this chapter.
Oh, it's pretty fun. And we can go on record for anyone who's listened before. Peter's a Giselle stan. So he's pro Giselle, particularly in this chapter. I think that you said off mic, this is your favorite thing Giselle's ever said, and you totally agree with
it. It validates everything I've ever felt about Giselle. Yeah, yeah, I feel validated.
He's totally
he's a king.
He's go off king
and a pog. Yeah,
yeah.
What I don't know, pog. What is pog?
King. It's
PAWG.
No, poggers, like pog champ. No, it's like a Twitter. No. Thing. It's like a Twitch thing.
I don't know.
PAWG. Pog.
Or poggers.
You don't know what
pog
you don't know about this?
I'm an old man.
Everyone listening knows about that. I'm not going to say what it is.
What is it? It's a Twitch thing. You don't know.
No, it's fat ass white girl.
Oh, that's not what I'm talking
what?
About.
Okay, this might.
That's not the same thing. Oh, my boy. God.
I don't know.
The cuts stay in the podcast.
This might be edited.
So I'm talking about I'm talking about poggers, which is like a Twitch guys. Thing that like. Okay.
Yeah. We can I'm saying that Giselle is a pog.
Oh,
but
I thought that was clear.
I guess I don't know the context. I don't know how that would relate. But yeah, he's a pog.
He's also a thought and a thought.
Yeah, he's. I mean, from
the prince,
from the parlance of my day, he's a bit of a twink, which I find sexy. But like, that's
get out of here. He's get the fuck
he's
out
a total
here.
Twink. Oh, he's like, oh yeah,
fuck off.
He's very hot right now.
No,
in the books.
But he's not a twink.
He's a bit of a twink.
He's like. King fuck of shit mountain. He's like not.
He's a Chad. You're saying he's a Chad. He is a Chad.
I mean, I don't think he's like. He is a Chad. I don't think he's like. I mean, yeah, he's a social. Okay, in today's world, he would absolutely be like an Instagram model with like millions of followers.
But,
and he's just awful. He'd be a Logan Paul or a Jake Paul. That's what he would be.
Oh my
god!
No
way!
You're totally right.
Oh god! That's
well,
too mean.
No.
I think
he
that's
has more
too
sophistication.
Mean. All right. Well, we love him. We stan him, except only Peter does and the rest of us hate him. Okay.
Yes. Agreed.
We're starting with chapter 16.
Mm-hmm. The Course of True Love.
Mm-hmm. We get Giselle going to meet Firouz, as he's done.
Yep. Trained for the contest, fencing with his fencing steels on
and
him.
He is as bitter. He got, I think from our last week's episode, got an hour added to his training. So he upped it from 4 to 5 hours a day by Varus.
Swimming in the moat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And it's still dark outside when he's like lugging himself.
Yeah. Cause
there.
I think he's going at 5 now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
just for a reminder, Giselle does not like to work. Giselle joined the army to fuck and to gamble and to like look good in a uniform,
right?
Not to do any fucking shit. So the idea that he is to wake up probably, you know, after drinking and it's dark sucks ass. I feel for my boy.
Yeah. So he goes in, and in the training chamber or wherever they're meeting up, there's someone sitting in the chair who's like, oh man, Vruz is already there. What a bummer. But so much.
Nope. Hobbled ass, tooth missing. Glockta's right there, turns around. He just wants to have a chat. And, you know, it really says a lot about Giselle that instead of having a short chat and doing no work, he would rather work rather than talk to Glockta, basically for no reason other than what you said, I think, in the first podcast, Gus, which is that, like, Glockta looks ugly and so therefore is evil and horrible to be around.
Well, I do like in this scene, basically, Giselle kind of tries to do a stare down with Glockta because he is thinking about him, like Peter, you said, and Gus, you said earlier, like he's like just gross because he's a cripple. And then he actually stares into Glockta's like wet, feverish eyes and like gets like a glimpse of like what hell itself is. And,
sure. And, so like, Glockta
immediately turns away.
Yeah, Glockta is waiting for him in the chair. And yes. He has been previously sort of, I didn't know if he'd go through with it, but Vruz, his old training master, implored him to talk with his new trainee.
I like thinking about Glockta's motivations for being there. I mean, we could say, like, it's out of what? I mean, like, respect for Vruz? No. Like, no. Care about anything? It's to fuck with Giselle.
Raw spite. Like,
that's the only reason why he went there.
Raw naked spite.
Yeah, he gets to look down on this dude who he probably sees himself in a little bit, but like a worse version of himself, right? Like, because that's basically what he talks about. Like, why is it that you even took up fencing? It's like the question he asked Giselle.
So, and yeah, Giselle sits down across from him and he's having like a traditional dad talk, like, or maybe an uncle talk, like sitting down with your slightly astray nephew and being like, well, what are you going to do with your future here?
He has a straight talk, tries to...
He's straight uncling him.
Yeah, and asks him the question, like, why is it that you got into fencing? And Giselle immediately lies and says it's like for the country. He gives an answer that he describes as like the perfect answer.
Unimpeachable,
like Glockta can't... Yeah, exactly. And he sees right through it, of course. He's like, that's, what do you think, I'm an idiot? Oh, God. It was so funny.
I don't know that Giselle has ever once thought about it. I don't know if he's even lying. I just think he's never for a single moment in his life considered why he would do it.
That is a great way to put it. Yeah.
He's answering specifically to try to be like,
yes, the best.
Because he knows whatever
answer,
he says to Glockta is going to come back to Vruz, and he wants to give, like,
right.
Yeah. The answer for Vruz. But yeah, he definitely has never thought about it, which is why, like, the second he gets asked again by Glockta, when Glockta doesn't buy it, and he says, oh, it's for my father. That feels like he actually thought about it for a second. Oh, I did it because my dad wanted me to do it.
He's mentioned. So that's his truer self that is also not true. And Glockta calls him on it immediately. And I like this whole thing that Giselle has surrounded himself with total sycophants, yes men, people that will never challenge him on anything. So he's been the big dick in the room, even intellectually with his friends. And he's like, oh, this is an opponent. This is someone who's actually challenging me on anything I've ever said, which is maybe the first time ever.
Yeah, maybe. Because he's also, I mean, I get the vibe that a lot of arrogance of Giselle's is warranted, right? Like it's birthright, and that he is smart. He is clever. He is quick on his feet. You know, he does beat everybody in cards, you know, but it's just that Glockta is like one of a kind. Great. You know, like it feels like Major West is the only other person that could probably go toe to toe with Giselle, and Major West just doesn't care to. He's a commoner, but also like
I think it would be somewhat compromising. He can only go so far because of
I think it's also great as like a meta version of sparring versus an actual duel, right? Like Giselle knows how to spar, right? He has the like the basic building blocks for it, so he can give the like initial answers, right? But Glockta has no decorum. He's not interested in points, right? He's trying to kill him.
It's like Fenris the Feared going up against a peasant. I mean, it's
exactly
nothing to Glockta.
Yeah, and we see very clearly that Giselle is not made for anything other than like following decorum, and Glockta has no use for it.
Right. So Giselle makes another, that he did it for his father. Glockta challenges him on it. They have a back and forth. And we see that he has anticipated some of Giselle's
terror about just being another noble, which Giselle's mentioned earlier. Like, he could just sit on his ass forever, but a few months of work and then you are the next level of noble above.
Yeah, you never have to work again. I mean, it is a testament to Giselle in some point that he is ambitious, even if it's like comes from, you know, a sense of arrogance.
And he's young.
Yeah. It's like, even Glockta says, like, there are many people that would like love to sit on their ass and just be a noble.
Right.
But Giselle wants more than that. He just doesn't want to work. I think he's just hoping that he's so exceptional and so smart and so quick on his feet, you know. But
there's the back and forth of Giselle, like, you know, initially he tries to leave and sees Glockta's glee that he's just going to run away. Mm-hmm. And he's like, okay, I'll stay and look at this disgusting monster.
Well, yeah, because he's competitive. He just doesn't like hard work, right? I mean, you know, the where we first meet him playing cards with the other officers.
So Glockta is one of the first people to tell Giselle something true about himself that Giselle hasn't considered before.
Right? Did Artie do that too? Or was Artie just like...
She put him on his heels, but I think that Glockta like clearly described like what Giselle's actual motivations are.
Right.
And they're so much more base and silly than Giselle is willing to
admit. Ian, would you articulate those for us?
What his motivations are?
Or what Glockta calls him on?
Well, he basically says that you aren't in this for anything other than yourself, clearly. Mm-hmm. Right? Is there more to that?
It's only so you can be one step above the other people in your milieu.
Yes.
So you're not the worst version of the incredibly relativistic scorn of idle nobles versus semi-idle nobles versus like tournament winner nobles versus combat noble. Like there's all of these distinctions with like these insane Byzantine hierarchies. And when we hear a little bit from this with Audie, because I think Audie is also a hypocrite, as we'll go into in a little bit, but it's all complicated. It's like you just want to stand on the shoulders of like, or stand just a little bit higher than the person just right below you. And that's real.
Right. Right.
And he also like appeals to Giselle's laziness. He's like, listen, all you have to do is work for 2 months.
Right.
And then you can be as lazy as you want. And all Giselle wants to be perceived as from everyone else is honorable and strong and cool. And if someone like finds out your base motivations and like gives them to you and gives you the version of the future where you can do everything that you want and do like less than nothing to achieve it, it undermines everything Giselle wants to think about himself.
Yeah,
it doesn't work.
No, Giselle has a baby's reaction to it. He's like,
I know,
fuck?
It's the
no
best.
I mean, it's the coolest part. So Glockta leaves and Glockta does like a good like, and by the way, I know your family will be sad and Varus will be mournful, but I don't give a shit whatever happens to you. It's like it's going back to Glockta is black pill. He's nihilistic.
Yeah. So Giselle then like fucking like protest to no one. Just, I love how much he's read. And he's like, well, if you know me so well, I'll just quit. Fuck
it's
you.
The best reaction. I totally, cause it is genuinely a great pep talk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chapter is also like, and I think it's pretty clear, but like, it's about how easy Giselle is to manipulate, right? Like,
I don't think that's no, I disagree.
Yeah. I do too. Actually. I think that Giselle
I think Glockta wanted him to not be a part of the contest.
But I don't think anyone could have manipulated him other than the two people that... Well, Glockta does probably manipulate him here. And then later, we'll get to it. Like, I feel like the only two people that could manipulate him are Glockta and Artie. I think those are the only two people.
My take on it was like, oh, Glockta's speech was actually 100% functional. That would galvanize me. He's doing just basic... reverse psychology stuff of being like, I don't care, but you are going to destroy yourself with being a basic noble.
Right.
And he reacts.
But Giselle doesn't want to be seen. He doesn't want to be noticed. He hates to be seen
I was shocked because, again, I haven't read this book in particular for a long time. I was shocked that he's like, I'm done fencing forever.
Yeah.
And I did not see that coming.
It just made so much sense. I loved it. It was a perfect reaction. He doesn't want to be read. Yeah, you think you won? Well, I'm fucking flipping the board, buddy. Like, the game never even happened now. Try to prove it happened. Oh, it's great. And he runs off. He stalks off. And
he runs into Yuru Sulfur.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. I really enjoyed that scene. It's like fun. Sulfur sitting outside, and he basically says, like, you know, I love to sit outside. I hate the crowds. You know, you just can't hear yourself think. Clearly, you're of the same opinion. You know, mm-hmm. And
he's a bit of a thinker. Giselle,
yes, exactly. And he also says to Giselle, like, well, clearly you're a thinker too. And it's funny because Giselle was just like stomping around like a little boy, like throwing a temper tantrum. And Sulfur's like, well, clearly you're elevated. You understand the importance behind solitude.
Yeah. It's weird he knows who Giselle is, right? Like, that's, it's weird.
Well, that's, yeah, it's a great scene because of that. Like, Sulfur, Giselle, I forget how they come to it, but basically Giselle says, I'm thinking about giving fencing up. And Sulfur is like, wait, no, you can't.
I think Sulfur just leads him into talking about his career. Sulfur's eating an apple.
Yes.
Oh my God. And just like Major West, we get another thing where like Giselle just needs to know where this guy's from. He's like, I can't place
no,
you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's also
light skin, tight black curls, has two different colored eyes, which is like an abomination to Giselle.
Yeah. You look weird. I got to know where you're from, buddy. I need to know whether or not I hate you. Like just on how you look. Oh, that was, yeah.
West and so we know Sulfur from, obviously, he's an envoy to Baez.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, he says, do not forfeit your fencing career. This is how nobles are made.
He says,
nobles are, yes. I mean, it's pertinent to sort of our position now. Like, nobles are allowed only by the collective acceptance from the proletariat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really striking. It feels like there's deep ramifications to this.
Yeah, and it's also just like a really weird scene. So like Giselle is like reeling from, he's just like, what the fuck? That was so strange. And then he's like, okay, let me manipulate my friend West into telling Veruz right. that I'm no longer a part of this.
That's what he comes away with.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Well, that was weird. I have to go tell the guards that there's a crazy person running around out here. But on the way, I'll go tell Major West, like, I'll trick him into, like, telling Veruz so I don't have to actually do any work again. Yeah.
Totally, yeah.
All right. Giselle waits a appropriate amount of time and then is going to go talk to, as you said, West.
Yeah, and he knocks on West's door and, lo and behold, it's Artie, mm-hmm. and she is drunk.
She's
and
drunk.
It's like nine in the morning.
Yep.
I think it's 10.
Or 10, yeah. And she just starts fucking with him immediately, because
holy
why not?
Holy shit.
Like, she sees him for what he is.
Oh, she ruins him.
Yeah.
She excoriates him in a way. It's such a fun bit of talk to read. I mean, she shreds him.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and also she says the things that he knows are true, but that no one would ever say because of the station that he's at, right? So she just sort of like jumps up the class hierarchy and addresses him as like an equal or someone that's above him, and he finds that very, very detestable.
Right, and they have like a bit of peremptory talk about like her life in England, and
yes.
She sort of wants to go back. I guess, because it's like, then I can just be riddled with babies and I'll have someone to talk to, which could come back in the most recent of novels. He's complaining about his fencing, and she's taking a bet out against him with her brother, right.
Yeah.
Major West.
Yeah, she's like, oh yeah, sick, I won, I've got this.
I thought you would quit, man. Yeah.
Which is just so funny, because like, when he first sees her, he's like excited about it, because Giselle's like into this. And it kind of has been into like the, you know, the like weird opinionated impropriety of it, even though it doesn't make sense to him. So this is a fun moment of having this like smash.
Oh, yeah. And it's working against him now.
I sort of read this scene as like Giselle, like, and it actually comes in a later book, Gus. I don't know if you remember in Best Served Cold, but Giselle likes to be domed.
Oh, he loves a dom.
He does. So when she's saying all of this, like his reaction is the reaction of someone who like methinks the lady doth protest too much. Like he's furious, but mm-hmm. we're like, he's too furious. Like clearly she's said things that he enjoys. So, but basically
she breaks him down and he does like a fun high road at being like, well, my mom, he's like, what would your mother think about you? And he's like, well, my mother's dead. And she's like, well, I'm glad she's fucking dead. Cause then she wouldn't have to see you talk. You dumb.
Yeah. It was amazing. Cause he was like, this'll shut her up. Yeah. I'll win this one. My mom's dead. And like, she doesn't care at all. Oh my God.
And she says a great line, and it like his Abercrombie's politics throughout this book, I think, are amazing. But she says basically, like, you rich kids are all the same, right? Like, you've been given everything and you hate the fact that you have to pick it up, right? Which I loved. It was just such a simple and perfect way to put it. And Giselle obviously hates that.
He's entitlement incarnate. I don't think that she isn't, right? Like, she is so much better off than most people. I mean, she's also a fucking hypocrite. Like, she's just sitting in a nice apartment drinking wine.
But I think the difference is that she understands what, like, maybe the motivations for why she's doing things. Like, she has a sense of
she's like
the world.
She's functionally middle class, but it's like, that's still a nice place to be in. Talk about the people like eight rungs below you, the beggars and shit.
I mean, but the limitations put on Artie are massive. Like, the problems that Artie runs into are ones of being, like, you know, kind of like too clever and too outspoken. Yeah. I mean, these are like pretty common problems that, like, Artie, like, is just in this world of, like, propriety and hierarchy. Has no way of actually, like, speaking her mind or rising to any level. And it's only by people like Giselle being fascinated by her in this moment that she has anybody. I mean, as she even says, like, I have no one to talk to. No one will talk to me. No one's around. The only person is basically Major West and Giselle. And we can see what she actually thinks of Giselle based on her drunken rant about him. Like, I feel for her.
Oh, I do too. It just makes me consider, like, the person, like, one rung below her, two rungs below her, talking to her in this way. There is so much. It's like, oh, well, you get to fucking hang out and drink all day, where we get sexually abused by our landlords or whatever. Like, there's,
I mean, I don't, yeah, that's true. But I just don't think that Artie be saying this to somebody like that. I think she has the tact for that, you know?
Yeah. No, but I hear you, Gus. I mean, she essentially slaps him around verbally.
And he is gobsmacked.
Furious.
Well,
so he's not even furious. He's like scared.
Confused.
And he runs out of the room and runs into West as West is coming back. And West is like, what are you doing here? Giselle says, well, I came to see you, but now I'm going to go cry in the corner. And West, like, walks in and he's essentially like, Artie, are you fucking drunk already? And then that's the end of their little thing. Right. And Giselle, essentially, he walks out and he's like, I've been the victim of a fucking assault.
I love that line. Yes. That line seems so pertinent.
Yes, so good. So it's a privileged thing to say in the fucking world.
I think it's read by Stephen Pacey.
It's perfect.
He's like,
it's perfect.
It's so pompous and so dismissive of what assault would, but he truly believes he was the subject of an assault.
Well, it also ties back to him talking with Glockta, and he's like, training with Veruz is torture. And
Glockta's
like, torture, you know, and then he's like, oh, I've been assaulted, you know, and
so he leaves. He's like just grinding his jaw. He's really pissed off. He does a whole rundown of what he thought she would be, and then that she was hot was like a real offense. He was like, and I even deigned to think she was hot, basically.
Right. I forgot about that. He does say that.
He does a whole thing. He's like, I stepped down from my like noble seat to talk to her, and I even thought she was sexy, guys. That's awful.
So you know what I gotta do? I gotta spite her. Exactly. Fuck this. Yeah. She's losing the goddamn bet with her brother.
Well, it's like that. It's like that Margaret Atwood quote where it's like, men just fear being laughed at by women. You know,
And
women fear being killed by men, but like, it's destroyed his world that this woman laughed at him. And you're right, out of like pure spite and like epic revenge, you know, he's gonna like restore his reputation to himself by just doing the thing that he like should be doing anyway.
Yeah, like doing the minimum amount of effort for massive gains. I look forward to a future scene with Glockta when like Giselle's like, look, I did it. I'm still here. Glockta's like, I literally didn't care. Like, I never cared at any point.
I didn't give it one single shit. I mean, how many times have we been galvanized by spite?
Oh, absolutely. It was one of the most like understandable things.
That's why he's the best character. That's why this chapter was great.
It's one of the great catalysts of ambition ever. Is just like
male ambition. Absolutely.
I would imagine it probably crosses genders, but
Yeah, I don't know. I can't. Yeah,
basic,
I guess I can't speak
pathetic,
to that.
Like flaccid spite is just. I mean, I've been through it so many times, and it's. I'm sure every internal monologue I've ever had sounds as weak, brothy garbage as his does. It's like, well, I will show them.
Absolutely. It just feels, it reads so authentically. It feels so authentic and real and embarrassing as fuck. But he has has so many layers of like kind of pride and justification that he will never see how pathetic it is. And it's awesome to see it laid bare like that. This character is just, he's just the best. I love him. I love him so much. I hope he keeps winning and keeps moving upwards for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, King. Yes.
All right. So then we're into chapter 17, how dogs are trained.
And you know, it's like locked a chapter immediately because it has a title like that. It's like the road between two dentists, how dogs are trained. It's just like, okay, he's going to give a speech about how dogs are trained while torturing someone. You just know that.
Non-functional. It's extremely non-functional with the road between two dentists. It does not land for me, his speech.
It's so edgelordy. It's so cool. It's not even that. He's going to train a dog.
I want it more edgelordy. Like, his dog speech is trash.
It's really awful. The road between two dentists was like too much. It was overly long and stupid. This one was just like, yeah, this is basic, like basic writing. I guess I felt like this is not interesting at all. This we'll get there.
Well, it does start out really funny, which is essentially Frost standing in the shadows. He hasn't moved for like 2 hours, and Glock is just staring at him like, who the fuck is this person?
I'm so glad you two pointed out him sitting the last episode, like sitting in the room by himself in the dark for a long time. Because this chapter reinforces that immediately. Like Frost hasn't moved.
It's just such a great visual, too.
Putty.
I love it.
He's a straight putty.
It's a perfect like representation of something. I don't know what it is. Just it's like it's scary and demented in a very specific and funny way. Especially contrasted with Severard, who is just like a clever sadist. It's amazing.
His fucking speech is terrible, but let's maybe go into the.
I mean, there's not much. I mean, basically,
bodies found floating by the docks.
You said that in the first chapter. I was like, did he say that? I don't remember that happening. But here it is.
No, he said it already.
Oh, really? He said it twice.
This is his second time.
I thought you guys were just calling it back because you love this
bodies
line so much.
Found floating by the docks.
So there's a sailor waiting on the dock, and he's going to pick someone three sailors. And we find out that the person that he's going to pick up is Goffred Hornlack. Yeah. I fucking love that name. Mm. And he's a like senior mercer. Essentially, Glockta.
They nab him.
They nab him. And then Glockta says to the sailor, like, you know, what did you see here? And he's like, oh, he didn't show up. And Glockta's like, well, that's the tale you should tell in Westport. And the sailor's like, oh, you offend me. How would I tell it otherwise?
That was what happened, bro. Severard snipes him. Snipes Hornlock's
like bodyguard?
Muscle, yeah. His bodyguard or whatever. And I love how Hornlock is like, help me. It's like, you didn't pay us for loyalty, Holmes. That's good.
You paid us to show up. Yeah.
That's good.
And then we get to the scene that you guys don't like.
They take him to the house, to Severard's old merchant house, and to the dilapidated mansion. They
start fucking with
him. Well, and he's naked.
They start fucking with him and talk about dogs.
There's like a fun bit of a naked thing where he's like, oh, I don't believe in torture without nakedness. I think that it only exposes them. That's not the actual words at all, but it's...
That's the gist.
He's tied to the chair naked. And it's like, of course. You would do that.
I do like going back in my head and being in like redrawing the picture of every other scene and being like, oh, the other person was naked the whole time.
Oh yeah. No, Hornlock is naked, tied to the chair and tries to be a little convincing. He's a higher mercer than Ruse. Mm-hmm. He's working under the main guy and tries to sell old Glockta on like, well, what do you want, buddy? I can set you up with some stuff.
Yeah, they even
and Glock just
mentioned,
like, no, I enjoy my work, you know.
Yeah, he even mentioned Superior Kaline, which is interesting because like we knew Kaline was on the take, but like having it stated so obviously and then just brushed aside was like interesting because it seems like the whole point of his mission is to basically find the goods on K-Line, and the goods are given right there. But like, okay, well, clearly that's not what Glockta's here for, because he just kind of presses on past it.
The charm of Glockta is how like fundamentally unbuyable rock bottom makes you. Glockta is, he has his whole speech. He's like, well, here's what I'd like. I'd like my teeth back. I'd like my leg to work. I'd like a dick again.
He
wants his life.
I like not to shit myself in bed. These are not lines, but this is what he says. Then Glockta talks about his mom, who he's mentioned earlier, which I don't know how many times he mentions his mom again, but
she comes up.
She's a rich noble dog owner, and then he does like this bullshit speech about
this is how my mother trained her dog,
and it's repetition, and who gives a shit? It's a terrible speech. I shouldn't have done it. I could have written it much better if I would have been a better writer at this point. Abercrombie.
It's faster than anyone. Hornlock just gives it up. He just gives it up. He's like, yep, I'll say whatever you need me to say in open council.
And then we get a little bit of like true sinister shit where Glockta's like, he just repeats the question again.
Yeah, like, what is your name? Yeah, that was scary. Name? It's not enough to get the confession. It's not enough for him to agree. It's like they're still going to go through it because he's going to be up in front of people testifying, right? And they're going after Magister Colt, who we saw like a few chapters ago.
Right.
Who was basically complaining about the Inquisitors going after them.
The dog sequence is such a bummer. Dogs are so fucked up.
The idea of basically doing a Pavlov thing is like, it's like basic thing. Like, repetition, and you have to hit them if they don't do what you want and repeat all of it.
I feel like, okay. I mean, I will say this, like, one thing that the chapter does do is introduce like just how far Glockta is willing to go. Like, it's not like he's tortured people so far, but like what he's about to engage in, and I won't say too much, is methodical and sinister and takes a long time in a way that is reminiscent of what was done to him. So we'll see in the next few chapters, but
I'm excited. I mean, I like the beginning of this chapter a lot. I liked how they showed him picking up the guy. Like, it was nice to see them doing their shadowy work at the start.
Yeah, I feel like in a certain way it is like a jump in like an elevation in his character. Like, we've seen him torture, but never like, I can't say it. We'll talk about it later.
I have no idea what you're about to talk about.
But anecdotally, dogs just have insane biology. Like, my seventh grade biology teacher told me about like ripping dog, because like dogs' penises have a bulb in them near the bottom of the shaft, so that
bottom of the shaft
that swell up. If you've ever seen a dog's dick, it's like there's a big like pool ball.
It's like an onion.
Yeah. Sometimes, and so that is to keep the female dog there. It swells up in the vagina so they can't move, because rape is most of the animal kingdom's like economy of sex. But
so you're wishing me, like, there's so much dog stuff don't do a Pavlov thing.
It doesn't underswell, so you have to sometimes tear the male dog's dick off if they can't get out of the sex engaged.
So you wish he had gone into that?
Yeah, this is what you want. You're like, I mean, he talked about dogs. We didn't talk about my favorite part about dogs.
No, I'm naming one thing.
Wait, Gus, your favorite part about dogs is rape?
Well, no, animals are mostly, it's mostly all rape. Yeah, I guess I'm wrong. You guys you burnt me.
I mean, that I was got just burnt. It's funny that this is where your mind goes. It's like, he's talking about something cool like dogs and not talking about their weird penises.
If you wanted to get grim dark, if you wanted to get a little weird with it and have fun, let's go into something different than she's like, the dog speech is, I beat the dogs and repeated it. Like, that's nothing.
Yeah, it is nothing. I mean, it is crazy how nothing the speech is. It is the most, like, it's the most
Make
first
it
draft
weird.
Of speeches.
Make it weird.
It's like, wait, who's the guy who wrote Ready Player One? What's his name?
Ernest Cline.
Yeah, fucking Ernest
Cline. Yeah, it's an Ernest Cline story. Like, that's what it is. It's like what he would have written. Because, like, God, fucking that book, man. Just like every metaphor was like the most obvious metaphor you've ever heard. That it was an Ernest Cline speech. That's
the chapter
is
named after, like,
it's like, get ready for this dog speech.
It's called How Dogs Are Trained. And I'm like, oh, I want something brutal. I want something like, oh no, you pulled the fucking jaw out from every third dog. And they realize that you, I mean, I don't know. You just want something fun.
Yeah. You don't want like, oh, she rang the bell. They salivated.
Exactly.
Hit him with the newspaper. Yeah.
It is Skinnerian. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how I know that Glockta is the favorite character. And yet, of the bad chapters, I feel like the Glockta chapters have been the ones that have the most like cringe shit in them. The Logan ones are boring. It's only Giselle that is like hitting every single chapter. Just epic shit after epic shit. Swinging that big dick around. I just can't get enough.
I think that we're... And by the way, I think Giselle has probably like a nice 5.5. I don't think that's a big dick. And
I agree. He's got, it's like utterly average, but yeah. You know, he shaves to make it look bigger at a time when that was like questionable, you know?
I bet he's hairless. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's a bit of a twink.
Bit of a twink.
Bit of a he's a bit of a twink. If I say so myself. All right. So.
Tea and Vengeance.
Was just trying to tease next out. Chapter. Yeah, thank you. Vengeance. Yeah. Chapter 18, Tea and Vengeance.
The Logan chapters are getting better. I feel like the Logan chapters were just rock bottom and just getting
this
slightly better.
This is a
better.
Fun
like,
chapter.
The last Peter, two have been so fucking
this
good.
This might be my favorite chap out of the book so far.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Other than every Giselle chapter, this is the best one. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. All right. Peter, you want to bring us in?
Well, yeah. I don't know why Logan, Baez, and Kwai are riding around horses not in the library.
Bro.
Where are they going?
They got places to be, man.
If they're actually going somewhere, it really felt to me like they're just going out on a ride and they're out on the ride for like an hour. And then Logan suddenly goes, wait, this is a bad idea. We might get ambushed. That's literally how it felt.
Well, they
to
left,
me.
I think, presumably right after the Bethod chapter.
This chapter reminds me of the chapter in Game of Thrones when like the wildlings take Bran hostage. And it's just like, they're just out there and just shit happens to them. Like it feels like, oh, they're just going for a ride because it's fun to go for a ride.
They are going somewhere. They left right after Bethod came with his seer and his giant son.
And
right.
And to be generous to Abercrombie, at the end of this chapter, we essentially get Logan saying, I don't want to know why or where we're going. Right, so we have as much information.
Right. We just have to get through the whole chapter of me not knowing what the fuck they're doing, wandering around, showing plants to Kwai.
That's one of my favorite things. Okay. I love this chapter. There's a lot going through here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's pull it back. So they are traveling somewhere.
We get a bit of Logan's tactical battle mind.
Yeah, totally. We do. He talks about the, how it's good terrain if you get there first to have a battle, right? Like, and he gives this whole idea of how you would stage a battle had you gotten here first, but says the important part is getting there first. And it's pretty cool. Like,
I love this rundown about
Joe Abercrombie. Like, it seems sound. I don't fucking know anything about tactics beyond playing StarCraft or whatever, but it feels like it correct. It feels like, oh, Logan's
a
genius.
It comes back
so insightful.
In later novels, particularly his fifth, like where all of this ground tactics is, it's all fleshed out.
I believe it. I mean, it seems like it's going to come back. It seems like a huge part of his character. It's easy to write like the great warrior, but Logan already seems like he has it all, right? Like he seems like he's got a tactical mind. He's got a clear head. He's a coward. He's brave. He's got a strong sense to survive. It's a very well-rounded character. You can see why all of his friends are here for
him. This is his first chapter of being really fleshed out.
And he's also practical to a fault, right? Like kind of later in the chapter, like Baez is almost talking to him as if Logan's a philosopher. You know,
he is.
Like he's thought about the deep questions, but he isn't. He's realized that the best way to go about life just so happens to be similar to like the great writers that Baez knows about, like I forget that Stolichus.
Well, so yeah, I love
like everything Logan knows about is only based on not dying.
Right, you exist long enough, you become wise, right? You gather enough experience. His experience is just like firsthand, right?
It's not about
cool.
The act of accruing wisdom. Like he doesn't care about the wisdom itself. it just, it's the individual aspects of like not dying that add up to, from a third person point of view, which is Baez, wisdom. Like it seems like wisdom, but it isn't.
Oh yeah.
Like, it is and it isn't, you know?
Logan is complex and we get some of that later. I love, this is the first mention of Stalicus, who is, I think, a direct analog to, like, my guess would be Pliny the Elder.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, he's a Roman author, a naval commander. I'm not reading off of Wikipedia. Oh, God. I was about to say
that he's similar to Seneca the Younger, or maybe
I do know Seneca. That
guy, no. Gaius Masonius Rufus.
Gaius Baltar, totally.
Or Chrysippus.
Yeah. No, Seneca, I do know. I don't know the other ones.
You are just so smart. You're so smart.
I just care
right
about
now.
History. Some people don't, but like I think it like informs.
So Pliny
our, like,
is all
future,
over.
So.
He's one of the only functioning historians of like modern Roman history. He wrote about it.
What about Heraclitus?
How dare you? How dare you?
No, Gus, trust me. You sound really smart.
Okay, so tea and vengeance. Oh, boy. So Pliny's, he's a good guy.
He's just like Pliny the Elder. Nothing like Pliny the Junior. He's like the eldest of the Plinys.
So we get that.
The point is, let's keep talking about this philosopher character who is mentioned one time. It has no bearing on the chapter whatsoever.
So Stalicus is mentioned a bunch. I think that he is Pliny the Elder. I think that is the actual literary allusion there, but let's keep moving.
But why? Why? Who's Pliny the Elder? If you're going to bring it up, like, go into that.
He's one of the few Roman historians that his work still exists. Most of the stuff he documented was about like 100 or more years after his time. But he's a substantial historian who was also a war historian, and particularly with the Admiralty in Rome. And he's also a natural philosopher. I mean, a lot of these people coincide. They're polymaths.
Right. It was easy to be a master at a lot of things back when everyone was stupid. And Baez says he thinks Logan is like that, right? That's...
Well, no,
this went right over my head. I've never read these books before. So, like, this was not something that was on my radar at all.
It's a bit of a Sun Tzu, like, the ground must be the general's best friend or becomes his worst enemy.
Does he quote him?
He does.
Him? Okay, he says, like, that's Baez quotes... What's his name? Stalicus?
Yeah. I don't know. I love it. I love it.
Zeno of Citium.
I mean, he makes sense. He sees that. Yeah.
There are like a few major Western historians who have survived great purges in documentation. And I like it when they're referenced even obliquely in fantasy text.
And I think it's also like another testament to just how capable Logan is. I mean, he's essentially arrived at the conclusions of these worldly...
He's so capable that he knows one of the plants that Kwai is supposed to know. Because they start showing plants to Kwai. He's like, Logan? This place fucking rips to fight on if you're here first. But Kwai, what kind of leaf is this? And Kwai doesn't fucking know. Kwai's a fucking moron who's bad at everything. Why is he an apprentice? Why is he with them? Is he the only apprentice Baez has?
It's very weird.
Like, this sucks. Bring a better apprentice.
I do kind of like, I mean, Baez says that, like, magic is leaving the world, right? And the spirits are going to sleep and all this. So, like, literally, Kwai might be the best that they have.
I don't know. But Kwai sucks. He sucks ass. You can tell how much Baez is like, Logan, please be my apprentice. Like, please let me get rid of this Kwai motherfucker.
The other thing he talks about here is Cowrib.
Oh, yeah. That was right. That was like pretty quickly. Yeah. Like, Cowrib is the real deal. I was being dismissive, but she's dangerous. She has the long eye.
She's a seer. Yeah. The long eye, which we hear a lot about over the books. He's like, sorry, actually, she's legit, and I'm scared.
So I really like so many things about Logan, and it comes up throughout the book, but like, he is afraid.
His tactic is running 100% of the time.
And as soon as Baez says that they're being followed, like a chill goes up his spine, and he is like immediately ready to, like you said, like run. But I think before we get to that, there's one cool thing that they do bring up where Logan, something about like the first law comes up, And then Logan says what it is.
Yeah, so it's... Well, wait, there are a couple things. I just want to touch on them really quickly before we get to that, which is the Baez makes tea, and Logan's like, the fuck is that? I thought that was funny. Like, what the fuck is a tea? You're going to drink leaf water? Fuck you. I'm gonna smoke weed over here by myself.
and then Kwai comes up, and he's like, can I have some tea? And Baez is like, tea is for closers.
But the other thing is that I think it's cool. Like, Kwai gets shown a bunch of leaves and can't name any of them. But I think it's another sign of, like, Logan's nature, that Logan tries to take pity on him and help. But Baez is seen through it. And he asked Kwai for a leaf that he knew Logan would know and knew Kwai wouldn't, because he wasn't supposed to know it. So I just like that Baez sees through it and catches Logan helping Kwai. I just like that moment. Sure. It doesn't really matter that much, but I like that.
I love it. I have been big into plant identification.
That's why you love it.
Well, it's called Wildcraft.
That's why you love this
scene. It's called Wildcraft, bro. as a nerd, as like a nerd who likes cooking, you don't have that many options. There is no magic. So I have been obsessed with like healing herbs and all that stuff, particularly in the Pacific Northwest where I live. I was just reading about ribwort today. It
sounds riveting.
It's all, I love it. That's part of their craft.
I mean, I appreciate that too. I just think it's funny that like what you love about the scene of like Logan showing some humanity and trying to help somebody out, but being caught is that they're looking at plants. That's just
part of their doctrine is like, I mean, and we learn a little bit more about that. It's important that you know every aspect of a thing that you're going to control. That's part of mage training.
Yeah, it's the implication here that Kwai is going to be like a plant mage, right? Like, because Baez says I'm a fire mage. Oh, really? I thought that was like clear.
I love that interpretation, Peter. Actually, I never thought of that, but that would be amazing.
No, I think that's just part.
I feel
of
like it's
the,
set. Am I wrong?
Part of the syllabus. Oh.
Yeah, I guess I thought that was specifically what he was going to focus on for some reason, because it comes up like right after he's like showing him the plants and something else specific. I wish I could remember. But yeah, Baez does say that he's a fire guy. It's like he takes the most alpha Chad of powers. Like, right, dude.
Yeah. He says fire, force, will.
Yes. Right. The most alpha Chad shit you can have.
And we get an introduction to the first law.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Which is super important. And I don't think we should skip over it. But basically, for the second time, we hear it's forbidden to touch the other side direct.
No
and
devils.
And then we hear what the second... Yes, no devils. And then we hear what the second law is. And it's forbidden to eat the flesh of men.
Yeah.
And both of those are just so sinister and strange. And it just it reminds you that there are great powers at
it
work.
It weirdly never comes
and
back.
And that they're... Yeah, it might never. We don't know.
Wait, it never comes. Oh, again? I love this. I love these moments of where you say like, and then nothing comes of it.
Oh, no, it does. Sorry. I would.
Oh, okay. See, I can't tell. Like sometimes you are like, it never comes up again. I mean, it's funny that Baez remarks that like Logan can talk to spirits and how remarkable that is. But I think you already said like, and the spirit thing like doesn't matter at all. I'm curious
it does
to see that's
only
the case,
a little, but it's dog shit.
Sure. I mean, like it seems like Logan has fire powers too. Seeing how he sucked up that fire spirit and spit it out, you'd think he'd just keep one of those in his mouth all the time.
Do matter a bit more.
I mean, it's called the First Law trilogy, so I assume
don't chill with devils and don't eat dudes. Yeah.
Forbidden to speak with devils.
Yeah.
Don't eat any dudes. Yeah. And doesn't Logan say something like, wow, you mages party hardy. It's not that, but it's something like that.
It is that.
Yeah.
And Peter, as you were mentioning before, they do like a bit of a, like they do a cheeky bit that I think is funny. They talk to him about crow's feet, whatever the.
Oh, yeah. The plant.
Yeah.
God, Kwai just gets owned relentlessly in this book. It is difficult. It is a difficult character to have around. It seems like he's here to be annoying and to get owned. It's almost like Joe Abercrombie is like, we know he sucks. I know he sucks. So we're just going to have him get owned constantly. It's like, just take him out. Yeah. Take him out of the book.
Yeah.
Put someone else in. Make it like a fun like animal character. Like I think we said before, like a Jar Jar Binks or something. Make it fun for the kids. Yeah, he's Jar Jar Binks, but without being really, really, really funny. You know?
Yeah. So they do the whole trick with the crow's feet, and then it's like, oh no, that would only be the label that anyone in the North would attach to it. And Baez susses him out. It's funny. And then we do talk a bit about tea, which I love the history of tea, but we don't have to get into that.
I know you're into leaves. We know this. Well, Plant Mage over here.
I do love tea. I like how tea came to England. There's like,
no, I know you can try to cover it up. It's mostly about the leaves, though. You're just into leaves. I get it. You're in the Pacific Northwest now where there's lots of leaves. You can't get enough of them.
Okay.
I get it.
Okay. I do think it helps us triangulate where we are in time in this relativist version of the world.
Yeah, I think that is actually interesting. I know you're really focused on like the historicity aspect of it. Like, you know, you think like the 1500s.
Like, tea didn't come till the early 1600s. Like 1620 is one of the first times from Portugal. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think Gus, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think you like very specific and strange world building.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like things to allude to that allude to greater.
I think that most of these things are informed by like tweaking history, and I think it's a pleasure for people who like to read history. Like I like Samuel Pepys, who is a naval administrator from like, you know, 1650, is one of the first people to talk about tea coming into the British Empire, and by 1750 it was their national drink, and there was a lot that happened in between. It's like tomatoes in Italy. Like it's way later than we would imagine.
Oh, do you mean Pepys, who was born in Salisbury Court, Fleet Street, London, on the 23rd of February in 1633? Is that the Pepys you're talking about?
I am not looking.
No, he's talking about like the Easter candy things, like the sugar birds.
Oh yeah, yeah, no. I thought maybe you were talking about it, like he had an illness as a young man, suffered from bladder stones, urinary tract.
He did.
He kept like a diary.
He did have a. Oh, I have his diary, you fucker. Okay, I'm gonna have to edit all this out, but
this is all gold shit. No, I appreciate that, and it is fun. Like you pegged it before, like the 1500s. With a lot of the stuff that's happening. So it makes sense that Baez is like, you know, he's just like into that new shit. He's into that new shit. He's into this tea crap that won't become popular for another like couple hundred years. And Logan is like, the fuck is that leaf? I'm going to smoke weed. Yeah. It's like ketamine right now. Like ketamine is like, you know, just becoming cooler and cooler. It's going to be the new party drug. And only the coolest people have figured that out.
You're
yet,
talking, you know, from the 90s. That's the...
What? No, the party drug of the 90s was ecstasy. What are you talking about?
No, ketamine was the party drug of the 90s, for sure.
You're out of your fucking mind. No, ecstasy was 100% the party drug of the 90s. It was like the party drug. Is this a joke?
No.
You're a fool. You're a fool for this
one. Well, I did all my ketamine.
Ketamine in like new music is like... I don't know, man. The new like... okay, never mind. Just ketamine's big right now. Okay, buddy? It's just big. What I read online.
How'd you get like a Samuel Pepys reference that quick, Ian?
Oh, I'm a lexicon. I have like deep knowledge about history. Again, because I care. And some people don't. Hold on, Gus.
Not even spelled.
I understand.
How would you know?
I understand that you have a cursory knowledge of history, and it's like you like to draw the facts. But like, I really like to delve into like how people feel about things, and like what their real histories were, and who they were as people. You know, so. Pepys is just, he's in there, man.
Here's my genuine confusion is, how'd you know when I said Pepys that it was P-E-Y-P-S?
Because you probably said the first name and he looked up the whole name.
Because I typed in Samuel P-E-E-P and Google said, did you mean?
Yeah.
Pepys?
I mean, I'm really into this because this entire exchange really reminds me of Pliny the Elder.
Thank you, Peter. Thank
you. Who was that, you know, a Roman author, a naturalist, a philosopher. He was a naval and army commander of the early Roman Empire. You maybe haven't heard of him. He was a Vespian.
Oh my God, Peter, I totally forgot he was a Vespian.
Or Vespasian or some shit. I don't know. Pliny the Elder, you know, from the Russian River Brewing Company in Amarillo.
All right.
I don't know where this is. You know, it's a beer. It's a beer.
All this will be.
That's the first hit. If I look up Pliny the Elder, it's a website for a beer.
Don't you dare edit this out. This is gold.
It's Sonoma County, Pliny the Elder. Anyway, so then Blacktoe shows up on a horse, and Logan realizes that they're surrounded and recognizes Blacktoe as a leader of some clan that Logan was fighting against when he was on Bethod's good side. You know, it's even a reference here, like. When Logan asks, like, why the fuck are you working for Bethod, Blacktoe? Like, I respected you. You were a named man. Like, why would you ever bend the knee? And Black Toast says, like, oh, well, my former chief, Old Man Yal, was killed by Fenris the Feared, like, you know, Bethod's champion, and alludes that Logan was Bethod's old champion, which is pretty fucking fire. And it's pretty sick to realize, like, Logan was the champ. Now Fenris is the champ. And we've seen Fenris. Fenris is fucking scary. Like, this is good shit to, like, think, oh, man, Logan and Fenris, maybe they, maybe they're going to fight. Maybe they're actually somewhere on some equal field here. It's also brought up that, Carib, like, dug up Fenris from somewhere, which is also fucking cool as fuck.
I did not hear that.
Oh, yeah. They say, like, Carib, like summoned him or, like, found him.
Yeah.
Well, I did. Yeah. I missed
I fucking
that.
Love that.
Yeah. And they find him, of course. They find Logan and Baez and Kwai. Oh, can't forget Kwai. Because of Kyle Ribb's, like, what's it called? Like, the long eye?
Long
like
eye,
the, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the implication. But, like, Logan, ever the one who's willing to, like, run away, is immediately like, oh, well, fuck me, I'm screwed. And he starts talking to Black Toe to kind of, like, buy for time, hoping an opportunity presents itself. And they talk basically all about, like, why the hell Black Toe would, like, bend the knee and all that sure. stuff. As some other Northman kind of approaches with a spear, like, getting closer and closer. And Logan, like,
yeah, it turns out there's a few more than they initially thought.
Right, because Logan fights his way out. He actually makes his way. He even, like, turns around and yells at Black Toe, like, I'm still alive, you fucker. And there's, like, some cool choreography as Baez and Kwai, like, run. But yeah, then there's a bunch more. Black Toe catches back up, his nose busted from Logan punching him in the head, and basically says, like, give it up, give me your sword. Right.
And then there's a great cool. and Gus, you've talked about this before, and I really didn't think about it until you mentioned it, but, like, the way that Abercrombie describes just the strangeness of, like, maybe movement or battle, but, like, Logan means to throw his sword down and he wants it to stick. It almost does, and then it just falls
that's
on its
just
side,
a
like,
bit.
Lamely, and it's just a great, yeah, it's great.
A great moment, though. I love it.
That's funny. He's like,
yeah.
He's gonna,
yeah, he just shrugs.
He's
it's
gonna
like,
throw
well,
his
fuck
sword
me.
Into,
not gonna
the,
be epic
yeah,
at all.
Into the dirt and it like and stick it up real cool. Like, is it before or after that he cut someone from arm
oh,
to
no,
tummy?
No, it's,
yeah. Oh, that's when he's getting yeah, away. Okay. Yeah. Oh god.
We learn about the sword for the first time.
Yeah, it's a good fucking sword. Yes. I mean, it's like not notched at all. It's like totally fine, despite getting some heavy use in this fight. God, it's cool. But then yeah, so they're surrounded. Logan throws his sword down. Baez sort of like refuses to bend at all, and he casts I think it's like level 3 fireball. It does like 66 damage to all people, but he has the meta magic feat that means that Logan, Kwai, and Baez don't get hit with the damage. And it basically auto kills all the nameless monsters that are like surrounding them, except Black Toe, of course, the named enemy, the elite mob,
right.
Is wounded incredibly by the fireball.
I think this spell is called Immolate.
Sure. Does Immolate have like a 30-foot range?
Yeah.
But either way, he's a sorcerer with like meta magic feet to avoid like friendlies in the middle and probably to maximize damage too. He's probably, or maybe he's an invocation wizard. I don't know. But
oh,
like,
he's in, yeah. Oh, yes. That is his class for sure. He's an evocator.
Right. And what's Logan? He's a battle master.
I mean, well,
if we're doing fifth edition rules,
maybe.
Sure. And what's Kwai? Kwai's just like a little shit. He's like
he's a level 0 who gives a shit.
Right.
I really love this scene because we get like Logan's like ties to the past, but like within the warrior class that he was a part of. And basically Black Toe is burned horribly. And
the archers are gone. There's a whole bank of archers. Yeah. They ran or they all rode on their horses to get away from Black Toe's droogs. And there was a blockade. And then Baez, there was a shimmering around him and he just fucking drenched everything in fire. And the archers are gone.
Yep. And Black Toe's burned to a crisp. Everybody else is just like outright insta dead. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's scary. And Black Toe's like, I'm glad it could be you that killed me. And Logan's like, I'm not. And then takes him out. Whew, that's some Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, one-liners. It was cool.
I love that last speech from Black Toe.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he regrets signing up with Bethod because Bethod took, you know, by force the entire North. We get a mention of a few of the people that resisted. namely Kremaki Fail in the High Places, which comes back. These are people that have resisted a total takeover of their otherwise distinct clan-based balkanized world, and you know, for better or worse, Bethot is aggregating.
I mean, and look what happened to Black Toe, right? He goes after Logan and gets burned alive. Like, what good was it? He should have just died fighting Fenris or whatever. It's like a waste. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it's also like, again, like, I know we've talked about Pacey here and there, but like this scene, I remember reading it in the book, and I remember it falling flat.
Oh,
but and
his delivery,
Pacey's delivery
of
this is perfect. It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. Like, really is.
The entire scene changes. It's really powerful. I've always really loved this specific exchange.
I didn't remember it at all, but it is so lovely as he's dying.
Yeah. It is good. Yeah,
and you get the notion of the name Men, and you get what they might feel for Logan, which is a grudging respect of the greatest among them, or the most ruthless, or whatever. We don't know much about Logan at all. I mean, even earlier in this chapter, we've heard Baez trading the stories of like, mothers would spit your name, like you were
exactly. All we know is the myth of Logan, right. And we know that he rejects that myth.
Yeah.
But we don't know how valid any of that is.
Right. We know nothing about it, but he is allegedly like a true scourge.
Yeah.
We know about it for the friends. We know about him from like other people talking about it, but we still don't know the scope of it. It's cool. It's cool to see all the different sides of him. He's a good character. He's a good character. Took a while. But...
I mean, he's no Giselle.
No, well, yeah, of course he's not a Giselle. I mean, Giselle is like a once in a lifetime character. You know, we've got a million Glocktas out there, a million Logans out there, but like how many Giselles do you get?
And so Baez refuses to heal, or he can't do it, but I don't know if that's ever borne out. But
he doesn't care. I mean,
he talks about how like we tend to specialize, right? Like we can't, and I'm not.
He's interested.
He's an evocator. There's a particular piece of writing where he's like, I don't know how to do it, and looks away quickly. And then Logan has to just get down. And it's like regret, futility, blood wasted. I mean, it's right at the moment where like Logan doesn't know if the blood in his mouth is his own or whatever. And it's just fucking unmourned, unknown. Whose blood is it? It's all meaningless.
Yeah, yeah.
And without Pacey, I mean, Black Toe is
boring.
Like, completely forgotten.
Yeah. Oh yeah, this is one of the places I really get what you guys are saying about Pacey, because almost immediately Black Toe is like personified perfectly. It's a pretty remarkable thing, both for Abercrombie and for Pacey, to take a character who shows up in one chapter and admittedly talks a lot, but to like get a full reckoning of this character, and there's so much exposition and so much personality in this.
Yeah,
that him dying is a bummer. I felt a little glimmer of hope when they're like talked about healing magic for a second. It's like, oh, chill. Black Toe is going to be like chilling with the homies here, but no, he's gonzo. He's outs. Damn.
Yeah. Logan uses that sweet sword.
Yeah. That's not fucked up.
And he drops beautiful. It again.
And I forget how this chapter ends, but I think it's,
Baez picks up the sword.
Asking Logan.
He cleans the sword.
Is that what Okay. Yeah.
And the sword
go ahead. I forget.
The sword is unnotched, and he's like, he cleans it off, and it's dull and utilitarian, which is sort of, but extremely deadly, which is like the synopsis of Logan's character. And then Logan's like, nothing's changed. Nothing's been different. Nothing's changed. And Baez.
Yes, that's what it was.
When has it ever? Is the last word.
No, yeah. Logan says, Black Toe was a better man than me. And Baez says, history's littered with good men.
Yeah, yeah.
And it.
I was just doing the last two lines are,
Is that the last two? I don't remember.
Logan's just distraught. He's everything's going back to the mud. He doesn't know what to do. And he says, nothing's changed. And Baez ends the chapter with, when has it ever?
Yes.
And
yes,
Logan picks the sword back.
Part one, too.
Yeah, and then you have the chains coming in the background.
What? Yep. What a triumphal end to that first part.
I'm excited to keep going. Yeah, it's exciting. We glossed over it at the beginning. I hate after all that to like dive go back into the chapter a little bit. But yeah, it's cool that Logan asks, like, doesn't want to know where they're going. Like, he's just like, fuck knowing anything. Ignorance is bliss. I don't want to have to deal with it. And I just want to point out that, like, I love the attention called to this. Like, I guess it's important because, again, I thought they were just wandering around, but I love the attention called to it because it's like, you just know Logan's going to regret not knowing where they're going. It's like, just, you know it. I don't know where they're going either, but, like, I don't know how he's going to regret it. Maybe it'll be comical. Maybe it'll be horrible. But damn, like, Logan, my dude.
Well, like, I couldn't agree more with Logan's sentiment. I think totally. I think that is my transition from 20s to 30s, is like, I've learned too much. He's like, every new thing I've learned is awful. It's made my life worse. There's nothing salutary in knowing more stuff. So let's just close my eyes.
I have enough experience to deal with it. I'll deal with it when it comes. Like, I think that is something.
Tell me exactly when it happens. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. No, yeah, I
and
like
it's
it.
Not just like what he's learned. It's like what he's done. It's like the decisions that he's made have led him to a place where everyone he knows is dead. Everything's gone. And so he's like relinquishing control to like a fucking stranger. Like, it's heartbreaking that it comes to that.
But
relinquishing control to a, go ahead, Gus.
Well, maybe that's that is the avenue to happiness, like there, or to some sort of internal peace, is just accepting like a backseat role.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, but I mean, it's faith, right? I mean, like, at this point in the world, I mean, like, God is dead in every meaningful way. We have to make our own decisions, and when you do that, you realize that
none
of them are correct, and you have no reason for them.
You're fucked.
And you don't know why you're making them.
Which is why you might as well record a podcast online with people living in different parts of the country over a Discord channel on Wednesdays or Mondays, depending on how we feel.
Or Tuesdays, as you.
Or I can't wait, dude. That'll be total anarchy. I can't.
You're going to disrupt.
Let's get crazy. Let's do a Tuesday.
In a real way.
I can't wait. Guys, these were some good chapters. I'm excited to get into actual part two. Shit's getting real. Yeah. I say that every time. Shit's getting real.
Peter, you're about to be introduced to a character that is my favorite in all of these books.
Yeah.
I hope it's like the village idiot or something, or the village drunk. That would be a lot of fun.
It's another predictable, like, if Glockta is my spirit animal, this next character is Ian's.
Oh, that's exciting.
I guess.
Yeah. Actually, Gus, that is fucking perfect, actually.
Yeah.
Wow. He like orders cigarettes from a deli with high delivery fee. I can't wait.
Yes.
So let's just close out this episode and talk about maybe how we felt about it for one moment. But next episode, we will be covering the following three chapters.
No, yeah, I think
if we look at the numbers on them, I think we probably need to do the next four.
Okay.
But yeah, something like that.
So it will probably be 17 through 20. I will let you know at the end of this episode if it changes.
Yeah, totally. I'm going to take a picture of it, of the timestamps, and send them over, and we can talk it up.
And if the world isn't burnt to the ground by next week, we will we'll do a Tuesday podcast, and it'll be fucking crazy.
Tuesday.
Similarly, if the world hasn't burned down and we do an anarchic Tuesday podcast, please send us as many insults as you can. This is something we requested last time.
I almost forgot about that.
You're welcome, Ian. I got your back. You know, I know you're a big dumbass that forgets sometimes. That's just a sample of what somebody could send to us.
Peter, that was perfect.
Beautiful.
That's exactly what I want.
Hey, you're welcome, buddy. I really kept the kids' gloves on there, but that's because I want to leave lots of
kid
for the creativity.
Gloves. Kid gloves.
The children's
pointed
gloves.
People in the right direction. Yes.
I think I edited that out of the last one, but
you did. Yes. Child's gloves.
Kid gloves. You fuckers.
Goddamn.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next
time. Bye, bye, bye.
Love y'all. Bye. Peace.
Alrighty, for next episode, we will be going through chapter 19, What Freedom Looks Like, chapter 20, The King's Justice, and chapter 21, Means of Escape. Alright guys, see you then.